Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. We have something very special planned for you this week. We have taken interviews that I've done with World War II veterans on my America's Veterans Story Show and reworked these so that you can hear these stories this week during Memorial Day. This is such an important week that we remember those that gave or were willing to give everything so that we can live in liberty and freedom and prosperity. I hope that you enjoy each and every one of these shows.
World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, and our other wars and conflicts. America's fighting men and women strapped on their boots and picked up their guns to fight tyranny and stand for liberty. We must never forget them. Welcome to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. These stories will touch your heart, inspire you, and give you courage. We stand on the shoulders of giants. Here's Kim Munson.
Welcome to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson, and be sure and check out our website. It is americasveteranstories.com. This show precipitated from a trip that I took in 2016 with a group from the Denver Police Activities League that accompanied four D-Day veterans back to Normandy for the 72nd celebration of the D-Day landing to free Western Europe from the evil clutches of Hitler and the Nazis, and return back stateside realizing each soldier's story is unique. It needs to be told. It needs to be kept, and hence this show was created. I am thrilled to have on the line with me Major General John Ron. He was part of the 5th Ranger Battalion, 1st Wave Omaha, on D-Day, June 6, 1944. We've done a previous show, and part one of this was broadcast on October 18th, 2020. So you can certainly just go to the website and you can Google, or you can search for that particular day, or you can put in Major General John Ron. That's R-A-A-E-N, and that show will come up. So General Ron, it's welcome. It's just great to have you here again.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be talking with you again.
The last interview that we did, we talked about the preparation for D-Day and going onto the beaches. And I found it so interesting how you ended up on, which beach was it that you were, a commanding officer was watching? He says, I'm not going to lose my battalion there. So why don't you take it from there so that we can segue the two shows together?
Okay. I'm going to take it back just a quick step farther back. And the mission of my battalion was to follow the 2nd Ranger Battalion up the cliffs at Point d'Auc. However, there was a timeline on it, and if the 2nd Battalion were not successful within 1.5 hour, we were to go to Plan B. We never received a message that they were successful, so we turned and moved to Plan B, which involved landing at Vierville, at the Vierville exit, sometimes called D1. As we were approaching D1, in three waves of assault boats, we were informed that the Omaha Dog Green beaches, which were was the area we were to land in, that they were closed because of high casualties. High casualties meaning like 95% casualties of the people that landed there or attempted to land there. They said, go to Dog White. So we turned and we started in three waves to go in on Dog White. And this is where you asked me to pick up the story. As we approached the beaches, we could see the first wave landing. Now, the first wave consisted of companies A and B and headquarters of the 2nd Ranger Battalion. They were attached to us, the 5th Ranger Battalion, in a thing called Ranger Force C. In any event, as we approached, we saw the first wave landing, and they were cut to shreds by the enemy forces on the bluffs overlooking the Dog White and Dog Green beaches. My battalion commander was watching from some distance offshore as they landed, and of course he had field glasses and he could see the gory details. And after a good look at that, he said, "I'm not going to lose my battalion on that beach." So he negotiated with the British flotilla commanders, and the flotilla commanders agreed they could land on another beach. So we moved to the left, which was the east. We moved to the left about 800 to 1,000 yards and landed on Omaha Dog Red Beach. We landed our two waves successfully over a front of about 200 to 250 yards. That was 13 boats. We had lost one boat coming in. 13 boats, each containing about 36 officers and men. And here we are stretched out over a frontage of about 200 to 250 yards. I was the extreme right flank, my boat, in working its way through the obstacles in the water, had ended up on the left end of the line. I was the only boat actually to land on Dog White, but we were so close to Dog Red Beach, I mean, we're talking 15 yards, that for practical purposes, we landed on, all of us landed on Dog Red Beach. I reorganized the troops, and you have to. When the troops come in, they get scattered. The wrong people are next to the wrong people and things like that. You have to check to make sure that the weapons didn't get any sand in the barrel and were still operable. And there are all kinds of little things that have to be checked to make sure that your force is a fighting force and not one that will go to pieces at the first shot that's fired at them.
Okay, General Ron, just a question there. Are you doing all this checking and reorganizing under fire?
Oh, yes. Oh, the fire was horrendous. It was mostly small arms fire. The artillery fire was landing down where the boats were, and that was 50 to close to 100 yards away. The reason is that why waste an artillery round on scattered infantry who have gone to, can't think of it, we would call it grass, but there was no grass on the beach. But anyway, who were prone, hiding behind obstacles. And if you fire artillery at them, you might get one casualty out of one artillery round. Whereas if you hit a boat, you could get as many as 250 casualties if it happened to be an LCI, or 35 or 36 casualties if it happened to be an LCA or a Higgins boat. So, yes, we were reorganizing under extremely heavy machine gun and rifle fire. But we had a little bit of protection from that fire, and saved the battalion so that we had only five casualties crossing the beach, while on other beaches we were looking at 50%, 60% casualties, and Dog Green, we're talking over 90% casualties.
My.
So, does that answer your question?
It does, most definitely. Okay.
Okay. In any event, we while I was organizing the troops, and let's be honest, the sergeants were organizing the group, and I had about 30 men with me in that boat. There were a couple of other people. The chaplain was aboard the boat. The assistant S3 was aboard the boat, and a medic was aboard the boat. But most of the 36 or so men were my men. And so we got them all straightened out while all this was happening. Major Sullivan, the executive officer of the battalion, who was on my boat, and I agreed that both of us need not go get the orders from the battalion commander. Now, why would we need orders? Why didn't we already have a plan? Well, we'd landed over a mile from where we were supposed to land, and we needed new orders because we were faced with entirely different terrain, and we were in an entirely different position than we were supposed to be. It also, we had our lives saved by the fact that we were on that beach. And I started to tell you we had several reasons why we had only five casualties and everybody else was running 50, 60, 90. The French had built 15 breakwaters. They call them retards, but I'll use the term breakwaters. 15 breakwaters on the beach where we landed. These breakwaters were about 25 meters apart and were about 4 to 5 feet high and consisted of large rocks. And I'm talking rocks that are a foot in diameter or maybe even larger. And they were piled in sort of pyramid type lines and were very, very substantial. And so if you ducked down to where your height was less than 4 feet, all the enemy rifle and machine gun fire would go over your heads. Sure, you'd hear the bullets crack, and you could. It was just a constant crack, 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 as hundreds and thousands of bullets went over our heads, but missed us because we were had the coverage of these breakwaters. The second break that we had was that the hill in front of us was on fire, and the Germans, who were supposed to be defending that part of the beach, could not see us because of the smoke and the flames. And the flames, as they approached the German positions, high explosives, hand grenades, mines, things like that, are very vulnerable to flame, and so are people. So the Germans, about half of them, actually ran from their positions, leaving a relatively light but blinded force there. We were coming out of the smoke and killing them before they even knew we were there, but that's a little bit later in the story. So the people above us who should have been shooting at us could not. And the people to our left couldn't see us because there was sort of a bend in the bluff structure. And they simply could not see us, so we didn't get any fire from the left. Everything was coming in from the right. But we were protected. The battalion commander, and of course there's some reorganization to do every time you move from one position to another. The mortars have to be in place, and the order of passing through the German obstacles must be determined because we had landed in a totally different place under totally different circumstances from the plan.
General Ron, just a question there. Now, my understanding is that in preparation that you'd gone over maps and new terrain, did you just know about where you were supposed to land? Was this a surprise then when you're someplace else? And I know that that happened to a number of the different units that they ended up where they, you know, they didn't think they would. So were people able to adapt quickly or how did that work out?
Well, it was very, very simple. We had studied the sand tables, the aerial photos, the maps for weeks. And as a result, I knew exactly where I was. The instant I looked at the seawall, I said, the seawall is wood. The only seawall on this beach is near Les Moulins. I am approximately 1 mile from where I should be. I mean, every officer, every non-com, every man, as soon as he saw that wooden seawall, knew exactly where we were and how far we were from the place we were supposed to be. So there was no problem with us on that. The Ranger training had taken over, and we knew where we were. The only problem was when we blow gaps in the barbed wire so that we can get off the beach, we have to know who goes first and who goes second. So that was what the battalion commander was giving orders on, was B Company, you lead through the hole that you blow, and C Company will follow you, or things like that. Within 10 minutes, 15 minutes at the very most, our lead elements had blown the holes, four gaps. The 5th Ranger Battalion blew four gaps in the wire, and we were passing through those gaps, crossing the flat land before the bluffs, and beginning to ascend the bluffs with everybody off the beach, certainly in 20 minutes.
Wow. Now, General Ron, let's stop right there. We're going to go to break and continue this story. It's amazing. Everybody within 20 minutes. We're talking with Major General John Ron about D-Day. Before we do that, though, one of my great sponsors of this show is Hooters Restaurants. They have five locations here in the metro area in Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, and Colorado Springs. They have all kinds of game day specials Monday through Thursday, 6 p.m. to close, and all day Saturday and Sunday. They have to-go specials. Wednesday is a Wings Day, all the wings that you can eat for $15.99. They have lunch specials every day, and kids eat free most of the days as well. So go to HootersColorado.com for more information. That's HootersColorado.com for more information. We'll be right back with Major General John Ron. And on the line with me is Karen Levine. She is an award-winning realtor with RE/MAX Alliance. We've been friends for many years. She's a great negotiator. She's a person to have on your side of the table, whether or not you're buying or selling your home, or if you're buying a new build. Karen Levine, it's so great to have you as a partner of the America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson show.
Kim, I just find it a privilege to get to be a sponsor of what I think is a very important program. We so appreciate the service of our veterans and to hear their stories and have an understanding of what they have done for us and for our nation. And I just appreciate that you are getting those stories out to people and that they're hearing the sacrifices men and women have made on behalf of America.
Well, and they really are a treasured portion of our population. And I know that when you are helping people buy and sell their homes, you really like to work with veterans.
I love working with veterans. I just think it's a privilege that I have as a real estate professional and as a realtor to help them achieve home ownership when they have sacrificed for us. And the VA loan that is available to veterans is such an awesome financing vehicle that allows veterans to get into home ownership with no down payment. And I love navigating that transaction for them, getting them to achieve home ownership and have an opportunity to build wealth by being homeowners.
Well, and people can reach you, Karen Levine, at 303-877-7516. That's 303-877-7516. And with mortgage rates so low right now, this is a great opportunity for veterans. And I so appreciate your sponsorship of America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Thank you so much, Karen Levine.
Thank you, Kim.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
God bless America.
Welcome back to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson, and be sure and check out my website, americasveteranstories.com. I am just so honored to be talking with Major General John Ron. He was part of the 5th Ranger Battalion that went on to Omaha Beach, first wave, D-Day, and we actually had a previous show as well. This is part two, and that show broadcast on October 18th in 2020. General Ron, during the break, we were talking about maybe going back and telling a little bit more about what you saw on the beach as you were coming on D-Day. So what did you see?
Well, the particular thing I wanted to tell you was, as I looked down the beach, we're safely on the beach, safely behind the breakwaters, and I looked down the beach and I could see tanks maneuvering, and I wondered why they were backing up to the water and then moving forward until they got to the sand dunes. And I used my field glasses and I could suddenly see what was happening. Now, these tanks are 200 to perhaps 500 yards away, but there are about five or six of them. And as they backed down to the water, the infantrymen who had been caught by German fire before they could get onto the beach and were using the water and the obstacles for protection, they would come out in groups of perhaps 10 and hide on the, what I'll call the shadow side of the tanks, where the rifle and machine gun fire, which was coming from our right, could not hit them. The tanks would then move slowly up the beach, across the beach, until they got those soldiers up to where they could take cover in the sand dunes that were beyond the beach. The tanks would then back down again to the water and pick up more soldiers. Now, many of these tanks were already disabled as far as their guns were concerned, but as long as their engines were working, they were dragging, doing the equivalent of dragging soldiers out of the surf, giving them safe passage across the beach to where the safety of the dunes lay. That was one of the things that I noticed right away, and it was very interesting, and if you stop and think about it, very heroic.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Wow.
The second thing I saw, and I didn't actually see it at first, I was sitting there watching the tanks and a few other things that were going on, and a couple of my men said, "Hey, Captain, look over there at that crazy guy." And I did, and I looked over there about 100 yards, 150 yards from where I was, and here was this I'll call him little old rotund man with a cigar in his mouth, walking on the beach where everybody was dying, and he was just walking up and down, back and forth, yelling at the troops in front of him, "We got to get off this beach. We got to get off this beach." I didn't hear him say that. He was too far away at that particular point in time, but that's what he was doing. And we tried to figure out, five or six of us, we were discussing it, and we thought, well, maybe he's a newspaper reporter who got hit in the head and doesn't know where he is. Or maybe he's a high-ranking officer trying to get the troops to move out. Well, in any event, he continued to walk down the beach toward me, and as he rounded the end of the breakwater, by now he was up to me, I said, "I better go down and see what this guy is. Plan A, he's crazy. I'll take him under control, turn him over to medics. Plan B, he's a high-ranking officer, and I'll salute him." And as I got close to him, he was rounding the end of the breakwaters. I saw a little silver star on his collar, and I said, "Plan B." So I walked up to him, I saluted, and said, "Sir, Captain Ron, 5th Ranger Infantry Battalion." And he looked at me, and he said, Ron, you must be Jack Ron's son." I said, "Yes, sir, I am." Now, just a little aside, this was General Cota, the deputy commander of the 29th Division, and his son young Dan was a classmate of mine at West Point. I knew of the family, but I had never met the family. But my father and General Cotto were friends, at least military friends, and knew each other, knew their reputations. Okay, so now we're back there, and we had settled the fact that we knew each other. And he said, "What's the situation here?" And I said, "Sir, the 5th Ranger Infantry Battalion has landed on this beach from here to a distance of about 250 yards. All six companies are getting ready to blow holes in the wire, move up the bluffs, and on to Vierville, which was our mission at that particular point in time." So those are the two stories I wanted to get out, the Cotto story and the tank story.
That is absolutely amazing to be on the beaches of Normandy and have General Cotto say, "So you must be Jack's son." That is absolutely amazing. Okay, let's move on then. You have blown holes in the wire and you guys are moving on towards your mission. What happens next, General Ron?
Well, we had to go up the bluffs, and as I said, they were still aflame, and there was a lot of smoke. And as we got about halfway up, the smoke was really quite stifling, and the men started asking, "Captain, can we put on our gas masks?" And I, of course, being the big, strong Norwegian type, said, "No, let's move out and get through this smoke." Well, there came a time after about 50 yards when the smoke got to me, too, and I said, "Okay, gas masks." So I took off my helmet, as you're supposed to. I put it between my knees, as you're supposed to. I ripped open my gas mask bag, which you're supposed to, and, of course, out fell my maps, my oranges, and a few other things that I don't even remember what they were. The oranges and the apples burst and rolled downhill. The hill was at least 45 degrees. I mean, they went fast. Mm-hmm. So I then pulled out my gas mask and with all my maps and papers, orders distributed on the hill beside me, and my men coming to hold them down with their hands and collect them. And I put my gas mask on, took a deep breath, and nearly died. I'd forgotten to pull the plug that allows the air in, and what I'd done was suck rubber into my face and gotten absolutely nothing in the way of air. I tore off the gas mask, inhaled a few more lungs full of smoke, and pulled the plug so that I could breathe when I put the mask on. And as I was putting the mask on, my knees came apart and my helmet started rolling down the hill. So there I was, helmetless, but I now had a gas mask on. I took a deep breath, and although it was dank, smelled terrible, at least it was fresh air, and I was able to survive that particular incident. I never did recover the oranges. I expect there's an orange tree at the bottom of that bluff by now. But my helmet was caught by my communications sergeant, who handed it to me, and I was finally re-equipped and ready to go. And we moved on up and out of the smoke into the hedgerow country and proceeded on from there.
Now, the hedgerows, General Ron, my understanding was there were real challenges with that. And so what did you guys do about getting through the hedgerows?
Well, I don't remember what I said last time, but we very quickly developed a tactic, and it was simply this, that when you got into the hedgerow, beyond the hedgerow, into the farmland, and these were big farms, we're talking 200 yards by 350 yards or even bigger. Some of them were almost 1,000 yards long. The crops had not yet been
harvested.
Thank you for the word. The crops had not been harvested, and these crops were mostly a leaf type crop, some like grass, some like leaves, where the crop was 4 feet, 3 feet high. So if you got shot at as you were there, you could drop down, and the enemy would not have the slightest idea where you were. And, of course, you didn't stay where you were, where you would drop down. You moved immediately. And, well, now, how far down should I shoot? I was aimed at the man at this height. Now, how do I go down 6 feet? You know, that type thing. They had no idea where we were. And you could maneuver in those crops to any place within the hedgerow boundaries that you wanted to. You could slide over the hedgerows in many, many spots and come down the far side of the hedgerow and eliminate the German position that had fired on you. And most of these were machine gun positions. I don't remember any particular rifle fire from the Germans, but I do remember a lot of machine gun fire. And they were placed at strategic positions along the hedgerows in the various farm areas. That was the way the infantry handled the hedgerows in the initial fighting. When we brought the tanks up, it was an entirely different matter. The hedgerows were so strong, so deeply embedded, so heavy with rocks and roots and trees and things like that, that the tanks had to use the entrances and exits to the fields. And, of course, the Germans were waiting for them with anti-tank weapons, and that did not work. But within a week or two, some bright engineer sergeant said, "Hey, we got a lot of obstacles, steel and iron, down here on the beach. Let's cut them up, weld them, and make them into scissors." So they made them into the scissor-like attachments, attached them where they would ordinarily put a bulldozer blade, and they would get back and run at the hedgerow, and these scissors would bite into the hedgerow. You move the scissors right and left with your tracks, and before you knew it, you had burst open the hedgerow, and the tank could go through a narrow entrance that the tank alone had created. Made quite a bit of difference in the tank part of the warfare of the hedgerows. So we developed fairly quickly tactics that handle both the infantry problem and the tank problem.
So you must be getting close to accomplishing your mission then at this point in time, yes?
No.
No. Okay.
No, our mission was still 6 miles away. And we had quite a fight getting to Vierville. Once we got on top of the bluffs, the artillery, which I'll call the indirect fire artillery, from a number of German batteries engaged us, and we took quite a few casualties from artillery. They, like we, had likely points of enemy congregation, and they would fire at those points, and if you happened to walk near one, you got the artillery. I personally got the artillery about twice, and I'm not talking one round. I'm talking like 30, 40, 50 rounds coming in on you, landing certainly within 100 yards of you down to within 10 yards of you, that type thing. It was pretty heavy artillery fire, and we took some casualties from it, but not as many as people might think. We worked our way up to the coastal road, which was about 1,000 yards in, without too much trouble. There wasn't that much resistance until the coastal road, but in the farmlands and the hedgerows beyond the coastal road, they had a machine gun in every corner and all along the hedgerows, and we found it just impossible. We could knock out an individual machine gun, but the instant you did, another machine gun would take you under fire. Now you'd have to work on him and things like that. So we withdrew from that, pulled back to the road, and marched straight into Vierville unopposed. I don't remember any more artillery. A few straggler riflemen maybe were shooting at us, but nothing severe like those machine guns, 4 and 5 per farm.
General Aron, let's stop right there and take a break. This is Kim Munson with America's Veteran Stories. I'm talking with Major General John Ron about D-Day, June 6, 1944. Before we go to break, though, another one of my great partners is Castlegate Knife and Tool. They are a family-owned business located right here in Sedalia, Colorado. Knives have been around since the Stone Age, and for good reason. They're functional, they're durable, and they're versatile. So whether or not you're a hunter, angler, or outdoorsman, a military personnel, or you need something for the kitchen, Castlegate Knife and Tool is the place to go. Check out their website. That is castlegate.com. That's castlegate.com. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with General John Ron. On the line with me is one of my valued sponsors, and that is Lauren Levy. He's a mortgage specialist with Polygon Financial Group. He works with a number of different lenders, which is great for you, the client. And Lauren Levy, welcome. Tell us, why are you a partner of America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson?
Well, hey, Kim, great to be back on with you. You know, when I had an opportunity to become a partner of yours on this project, I thought it was just a perfect fit. Anytime you can do things that try to help the people that have served our country, whether in action or not, you know, they have made sacrifices and to help defend our country. And I just thought it was a great chance to try to give back a little bit and see if I couldn't help those folks out.
And there is great opportunity for veterans and military personnel right now in the mortgage arena. You and I were chatting before we did the call that there's something very special, I think, for veterans.
Yeah, and, you know, the VA loan, which is available for all veterans or active duty folks, has always been a good program. And it's always had good rates and allowed for no mortgage insurance for people that borrow or don't have a big down payment. It also allows veterans to pay cash out of their home up to higher levels than regular loans. And on top of that, it's always had great rates. Well, now, you know, through the pandemic and just with some different specials and things, lenders have really low rates on these VA loans. We're talking things in the lower 2.375, where these veterans can really lower their payments and take advantage of these great rates.
Well, that's something that would be a great idea. People can reach you, Lauren Levy, at 303-880-8881, 303-880-8881. You and I always say, when opportunity knocks at the door, you should open it. And this is a great opportunity for veterans right now, Lauren Levy.
I agree 100%. You know, if you have a rate anywhere over 2.875 or above, I think it's a good time to be looking at doing even just a VA streamline. They're easy to do. They don't take very long, and it can really save these veterans some important money right now.
And again, call Lauren Levy at 303-880-8881, 303-880-8881. Lauren Levy, thank you so much for your partnership. Hal Van Herke with Castlegate Knife and Tool. It's a family-owned business located right here in Sedalia, Colorado. Hal Van Herke, you are a treasured partner.
Thank you, Kim. We appreciate being on, and we are very proud to be a partner with everything you've got going on here.
And one of the things, you have a wide array of knives at Castlegate Knife and Tool, but one of the things that you have is knives for military personnel. And I know that tool, that is so critical for our military personnel to have something that they trust that feels good in their hand, and you can help people out with that.
Yeah, the knives, we sell a whole variety of knives, from basic pocket knives to knives that are designed specifically as combat knives to take on deployment. We have a brand, for example, in the latter category called Spartan Blades, which is owned by two retired special forces, Green Berets out of North Carolina. We have another brand that's run predominantly by retired Marines out of Arizona. So we're very big on supporting the veteran community. Our business is veteran-owned. I was in the Army and for a brief time in the Air Force as well before I went into some intelligence activities, and our store general manager is a retired Marine, so we look very favorably on the community and the people who early on in their life committed and sacrificed to their country, and we really look at that community as being our favorite community. We offer veterans a 10% discount on everything in the store every day of the year. So.
Well, I really appreciate that. I appreciate your service. And Hal Van Herky, we are getting near the holidays. It's hard to believe. And Castlegate Knife and Tool is a great place for people to do their holiday Christmas shopping.
Yeah, we find every year that people are excited when they find out we exist. And if they want to come into the physical store located in Sedalia or reach out on our new website that we're launching on the 18th, and find out that knives are very good gifts every year. People love finding that extra little thing they can use as a stocking stuffer or find a knife for that hard-to-please person on your Christmas list or your father or somebody who says, oh, I don't know what I want. Everybody likes knives. Everybody in the world owns a knife. It's the one thing that unifies us all.
Okay. More information, go to castlegate.com. That's castlegate.com. Hal Van Herky, thank you so much.
Thank you.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, KimMunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
From the mountains to the
Welcome back to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That is americasveteranstories.com. I have the great honor of talking with Major General John Ron. He was with the 5th Ranger Battalion on D-Day, June 6, 1944. We're just talking about day one of D-Day as we've gone through these stories there. It's absolutely amazing. This is actually part two. Part one, you can listen to, and that was broadcast on October 18th in 2020. So you can find that on the website underneath that date. So General Ron, a lot has happened. This is still day one of D-Day, correct?
Yes, this is still day one of D-Day, and the time is probably around 9:30 or 10. I'd put it there. In any event, in trying to penetrate to the south through the hedgerow structure past the coastal road, we finally gave that up as being too expensive in the way of casualties and time. And we turned and marched, for practical purposes, straight down the road as if there were no war at all. There were some enemy stragglers who shot at us and a few things like that. And there was some artillery that hit road intersections occasionally, but they had other observed targets that they wanted to get at, so we didn't get too much of that. We got into Vierville and our lead elements, and I want to say that with us, with my six companies, or with the six companies of the 5th Ranger Battalion, we had picked up two additional companies of Rangers, the survivors who had landed on Dog White Beach. They had moved up the bluffs under non-coms. All the officers were killed or wounded. They moved up the bluffs, wiped out a German strong point, which was the one who was giving the most machine gun fire on the beach, and joined us. However, their casualties were so high that we combined the two companies into one and just called them the provisional company. So we picked them up. We also had picked up Company C of the 116th Infantry, who had landed on Dog White. They had sustained very few casualties in crossing the beach and working their way up the bluffs, and they had joined us, and together this column moved through Vierville until C Company of the 116th and B Company of the 5th Rangers ran into German fortifications on the far side of Vierville. Now, those fortifications were very strong, and they held us up for quite some time as we attempted to organize a battalion attack of those positions. The main reason that we wanted a battalion attack on them was we wanted to defeat them quickly so that we could get on with our main mission, which was to march to Pointe d'Hoc and capture Pointe d'Hoc from the land side where all the cliffs and the guns and things were supposed to be. So that was the situation. We are organizing a major attack on these German fortified positions when we were informed by the 29th Division, forget it, you are not going to Pointe d'Hoc. The beachhead is too fragile to last during the night if we allow seven Ranger companies and the 1st Battalion of the 116th Infantry, which had one good company and then a whole bunch of survivors. If we let them go and you go, we won't have enough force to maintain the beachhead during the night. The Germans will counterattack, drive us back into the sea. So we went into night positions and expecting German armored counterattack. Never came. Did come the next morning as we were released to go to Pointe d'Hoc. The Germans attacked in a couple of places in company strength size, and as a result, the majority of the battalion was held back to help protect the beachhead. But two companies plus the what was left of the 116th Infantry's 1st Battalion, that was the advance guard, they proceeded on toward Pointe d'Hoc and moved very, very fast and probably could have relieved Pointe d'Hoc a little after noon, but they proceeded on beyond thinking that they could surprise the Germans at Grandcamp. But when they got inside of Grandcamp, the resistance stiffened. The artillery drove that force back, and we spent the night about 1,000 yards from Pointe d'Hoc in a little town called Saint-Pierre-du-Mont.
Now, and, just a quick question on this. I think that it's important for people to understand that Hitler was expecting some kind of an attack, some kind, on the beaches somewhere. He didn't know for sure where it was, but he had spent many years fortifying these beaches. And it's astounding to me that you guys were able to, you know, get over the beaches and, past the hedgerows in the first day. I find that absolutely amazing, General Ron.
Well, in a sense, it is amazing. When Rommel came in and became the commander of the defenses of the Normandy coast, he found them in terrible disarray, and he spent close to a year fortifying, putting in concrete artillery positions, putting in obstacles in the water, digging trenches along the crests of the bluffs and things like that. He was really beginning to get it thoroughly fortified to earn the title of Festung Europa. But he had not finished. And what he had was a thin shell, because his concept was kill them on the beaches and they won't bother you inland. Von Rundstedt thought it was better to let the people land and to counterattack and destroy them up in the hedgerow country. Rommel won that argument, but he only had a thin crust of fortifications along the crests of the bluffs and the cliffs and things like that. So once we penetrated there, we were fighting Germans more or less on our terms. They didn't have emplacements except in the hedgerows themselves, really part of the counterattacking force. That is, they would give the fire support for a counterattacking force, which was located about 1,000 to 2,000 yards off the beach. They had some five battalions of infantry, very well-trained infantry, to counterattack. And that's what this machine gun structure was for, was to hold us up long enough that the five battalions of infantry could organize a counterattack against the specific penetration. It was very well conceived, but it was only a crust, and we broke through it the first day. And from there on, movement was fairly rapid if you wanted it to be rapid. It was costly, but it was rapid.
Okay, so you now are at the end of the first day. And what time did you start that day?
What time?
Mm-hmm.
The first day we were supposed to land. HR was 6:30 in the morning. By the time we actually landed in those breakwaters, it was 7:50. I looked at my watch as I went down the ramps of the assault craft, and that's been pretty well established as the time that the third Ranger wave landed on Omaha Beach.
And what time did you get in the boats that morning?
4:30.
Okay, 4:30, and so you've fought all day, and now it's nightfall. Can you rest? What do you have to eat? Tell us about that.
Well, when we went into night fighting positions around Vierville at the end of D-Day, the only rations that we had were chocolate D rations. They're a very bitter chocolate, so hard it's almost like eating jaw crunchers. And the D-bar itself is no bigger than the palm of your hand. So it wasn't much food. Most of us had about five or six of those with us in our packs, the packs on our backs. But that's the only thing we had for food. But a strange thing happened. Somewhere or other, somebody found a water bag and erected it on a tripod and filled it with water, and we were able to fill our canteens from this, what we called a Lister bag. And as a result, we had plenty of fluids, and we were thirsty. Believe me, we were thirsty. But now we had plenty of water. Most of us, like myself, we're carrying about three extra bandoliers of rifle ammunition, and I think a bandolier consisted of 10 clips, which is 80 rounds per bandolier. So we were mostly carrying around 240 extra rounds of rifle ammunition. The machine gun crews and the squads that they were supporting. Every man carried a box of machine gun ammunition, which he left with the machine gunners, and that gave them enough ammunition to fight through D-Day. By the middle of the second day, when we were on our way to Saint-Pierre-du-Mont, we were running out of ammunition. The troops had expended so much ammunition that we were actually beginning to run out. And that was one of my heroisms, was going down to the beach, meeting with General Gerhardt, the 29th Division commander, who remembered me as a kid, fortunately. And he was very kind. He had his aide-de-camp go with me down to the beach. We got a jeep. We dewaterized it, or whatever they call, taking off all that gook off the spark plugs and out of the exhaust tubes and things like that, and loaded it up with ammunition, and then drove 5 miles through enemy country to resupply the force that was attacking or getting ready to attack Pointe aux Trembles. I'll tell you, it was a thrilling ride to be 5 miles of being shot at by machine gun and stragglers, and it was thrilling.
That would be thrilling with a capital T, I think, General Ron. We have just about a minute left for this particular show, and at this point I want to invite you to do another recording. This is just history that we are learning, and I just find it so valuable. What is the final thought that you'd like to leave with our listeners on this particular show, General Ron?
Well, for the military people who are listening, it all depends on training. The better the training, the better the performance of the troops. We knew that every single Ranger, because of his training, would aim his rifle before pulling the trigger. When we had a 5 or 6 man rifle team, we knew that they could outperform an infantry squad with aimed rifle fire. Just, we were unbelievable shots. Every man was an expert rifleman, and every man had been trained under the most trying of live fire exercises, how to shoot in combat and things like that. Our troops performed, and it was all training. And it was training of the officers. The Marines say, when you're surprised, improvise. Or when things go wrong, improvise. Well, our people were trained exactly the same way. They're given a mission. Obstacles that they didn't expect are put in front of them. Improvise, but accomplish the mission. That's the way you win wars.
Wow. Major General John Ron, this is absolutely fascinating. My friends, we're going to schedule another interview with General Ron, so stay tuned on that. We're out of time right now, so my friends, continue to listen to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson, and God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you for listening to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday, 3 to 4 p.m., here on KLZ 560 and KLZ 100.7.